Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 31st podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, a lot of stuff going on in the sports world. Actually, it's a great time to be a sports fan. Cubs and Sox recently opened up their seasons in the MLB. The Bulls and the Hawks winding down. We'll talk about them and give them a bit of a season in review. We've got the Bears starting OTAs very soon. And, of course, as always, a very intriguing special guest later in the show. With him, we'll be talking about some NCAA March Madness, some NFL news, and about his great career in broadcasting. But first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at John Zags. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Mucci World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 171st Street here in Tinley Park. You can contact them at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. Let's start off today talking about some Chicago Cubs news. Right now, the team is 5-4, second place in the NL Central, and some interesting storylines going on right now for the team. First of all, I was right. I have to say it, I was 100% right about Kyle Schwarber, and I'm not afraid to admit it. So far this season, a 172 batting average, although he does have two home runs, but everybody was talking about him losing weight and him becoming more athletic, him becoming more agile. Well, you know what? He's made multiple errors in the outfield, and he's hitting a .172 at the plate. When is everybody going to realize that he is not who he is portrayed to be? Some sort of superstar, some sort of Adonis for the Cubs. He's not turning out like that once again this year. Now, this season, this is his chance to really shine. It's going to be his first full, quote-unquote, season. I mean, last year technically was it, but because of being demoted to AAA, we'll give him one more chance this year. But based on what I've seen so far, I have to say I am appalled by his performance. I mean, the outfield. He is just atrocious out there. This guy is an American League hitter. I've said this from the beginning. I'll say it again. The Cubs need to do something as far as trades go and get rid of him while he still has value. Schwarber could be a boon to some certain American League teams, teams who need some designated hitter help. He could fill in at first base and provide some quick power in the lineup. He's actually quite similar to a guy like Joey Gallo, third baseman on the Rangers. I mean, last season, hit under 200, but did have 40 home runs. I feel that Schwarber in that situation specifically, one similar to Joey Gallo, would do quite well. But right now, here with the Cubs, it's not working out. You can't have a guy play left field who's a defensive liability in the National League. It's just impossible. And what Schwarber has done over these first 9 games out there has just been atrocious. He's not even as good as a guy who is quote-unquote replacement level. Somebody who's 0.0 on the war scale. His defensive war, in fact, is already at a negative 0.2. I mean, that's just horrible. When you're talking about the fact that we've only been through 9 games in the season. That's unbelievable. That is something that is intolerable. And the Cubs right now, they really have to evaluate what Schwarber means to this team. And I'm just so happy that I got this one right. Because everybody was talking about him losing weight. And everybody was worried about him being a better player this season after last year's struggles. And it turns out, as I said before, he's just going to keep doing horrible, and sure enough he has, right out of the gate. Has not done well for the Cubs so far, and that is just a liability issue. They've got to correct that if they want to go far this season. But for a moment, let's stop scrutinizing Schwarber, because when you look at the Cubs lineup right now, there are only 2 players who are doing relatively well. That's Wilson Contreras and Chris Bryant. I mean, Rizzo, and I know he's been hurt a bit, hitting 107, Baez at 148. Schwarber, as I mentioned, is at 172, and Ian Happ at 179. And my buddy Jason Hayward, who still cannot hit his way out of a paper bag, hitting 222. So when you have two guys producing in your lineup, that's going to be a problem. Luckily, the Cubs also do have, though, Ben Zobrist doing well in limited time, hitting .360, and Tommy La Stella in 12 at-bats, hitting .333. So some bright spots for their offense, but they need more consistent production out of some of their bigger players, like Anthony Rizzo, and especially Javier Baez. On the mound, however, they've been doing okay. Not great, but better than some other teams are in this position right now. John Lester and Tyler Chatwood both sporting ERAs under 3.0. Yu Darvish in two starts, an ERA over 5, and Hendricks and Quintana ERAs just over 4. Those will go down with time. But the big storyline, in my opinion, coming out of the Cubs team so far is their bullpen. How great has it been right now? I mean, it's stunning when looking at the ERAs of everybody in the Cubs bullpen. Brandon Morrow, Justin Wilson both had 0. Strope the same and Dunson. Cishek at 1.69, Edwards 1.80, Montgomery right under 3, and Butler at 1.13. I mean, that is what has really carried this team so far. Unfortunately, however, a bullpen alone is not going to necessarily win you games or put you into a pennant race, so the Cubs are going to need other aspects of their team to start catching some life, and I'm sure that won't be a problem come mid-season and the season's end. But right now, their bullpen is on fire. And they're going to need it to do well throughout the season because there are going to be tight games later on in the year, September, then into the playoffs in October and possibly November. They need these guys healthy and ready to go at that time. I will say this, though. If the bullpen can perform at this same level at the end of the year, really watch out for the Cubs because, as we all remember from last season, back against the Nationals, Carl Edwards, and even against the Dodgers, the bullpen for the Cubs was a weakness. They've really improved by going out and getting Brandon Morrow and Steve Cishek, and having Justin Wilson on for the entire season has helped him out personally on a mental level. Nevertheless, this is an interesting Cubs team, one that the bullpen is currently carrying right now. Once other parts of the team can start to catch fire, especially that lineup, watch out for the Cubs as they will be yet another contender this year for the World Series. And sure, you can claim that this is some Cubs bias from a Cubs fan, but I mean, the numbers don't lie. Once these batters can really catch fire, guys like Rizzo, once they're off the mend, hitting 30 homers a year, Chris Bryant in the midst right now of an early MVP season, and I know we're just 9 games in, a bit premature to say, but looking at his numbers right now, his slash line, an OPS over 1,000, these are guys that will propel the Cubs into first place in the division and to another possible World Series. Watch out for the Cubs as we get going here in 2018. On to the South side we go, talking about the Chicago White Sox. Right now, 3-5 record, fourth place in the AL Central. Now, despite that record, the Sox right now showing some displays of power. 14 home runs as a team so far through their first 8 games, which is just unbelievable. They have more home runs, and certain players have more home runs, like Matt Davidson, than other teams entirely. It's quite interesting what the team is doing right now. Looking at some players who have been producing quite well early on. Yolmer Sanchez at .296. Avi Garcia picking up where he left off last season, starting at .343, and Matt Davidson, although the .250 batting average, has 4 homers and 8 RBIs, 3 of which came on opening day. And by the way, that's a pretty interesting statistic if you get a chance to look it up. There have been 3 players before Matt Davidson to ever hit 3 home runs on opening day. 2 of them former Cubs players, one of which did it as a member of the Cubs. The first is George Bell on April 4th, 1988, a part of the Blue Jays. He was the reigning AL MVP, then comes up, hits 3 home runs on opening day the next season. Here's the former Cub, 1994, Carl Tuffy Rose. He hit 3 home runs with the Cubs, ended up not doing so well here in America, went over to Japan, and now, by the way, has the single-season home run record in Japan. How interesting is that? Quite an interesting story. And finally, Dimitri Young with the Tigers, April 4th, 2005. And at the time, little did Tigers fans know that just about a year and a half later, they would be in the World Series. So anyway, quite interesting. But looking at the Sox as far as pitching goes, Reynaldo Lopez so far, 2 starts, .69 ERA. What a start to the season for him. We talked about in our last podcast how Lopez really had a chance to break out this year. He was a youngster last season, did okay, a bit rocky at times, but he was still a rookie. And right now, he is doing well on a big level. But besides him, no one necessarily dominated. Giolito, Shields, Fulmer, and Gonzalez all have ERAs above 5.4. That's a problem, but hopefully they can all go down. In the bullpen right now, things a bit dicey. Joaquin Soria has 2 saves at the moment, but also a 9.0 ERA. Danny Farquhar at 3.86, Greg Infante at 23, Avilan at 3.38, Hector Santiago coming out of the bullpen, and that is quite interesting because we were assuming he'd possibly get a chance to start, but right now in the bullpen at 5.79, Nate Jones at 2.70, and Bruce Rondon recently called up right now at 0.00. And by the way, speaking of Bruce Rondon, any Sox fans out there, go to a game to see him pitch because you will not be disappointed. Rondon started his career in Detroit, was a top prospect due to his ability to throw 100 miles per hour in a consistent manner. I mean, he was really highly touted. He ended up getting Tommy John surgery with the Tigers, then didn't fare so well, fell out of favor with then-manager Brad Ausmus, was released this year and came to the White Sox. And so far, although a small sample size at an inning and a third, still at a 0.0 ERA. Rondon could be a key piece of this team, and keep in mind, too, that they barely spent any money on him, getting him on a minor league patch. So that could turn out to be a low-risk, high-reward investment for the Sox coming up. Now, as far as the team goes, however, I'm very surprised and impressed with the way they've been playing so far. I mean, sure, they have a 3-5 record, but that's not news to anybody. We all knew coming into the season that the Sox were not going to necessarily turn any heads. They weren't going to make the playoffs. They were not even supposed to finish above 500. 3-5 is okay right now, but looking at their lineup, you can slowly start to see this team's future. All of these guys are playing particularly well right now. Some better than others, obviously. But, I mean, you can't argue with 14 home runs in 8 games. That is very impressive. These Sox players, especially, are building off of each other as well. They're realizing that they're only a few years away from really making an impact on the franchise and on the city itself. This lineup is starting to mesh together very well. And once we see a couple of the top prospects from the minor leagues come in and make their mark, this will be an impeccable lineup. One that will wreak havoc amongst AL pitchers. Look for the Sox this year, as we mentioned in the last podcast, to not win tons of games, but to have a lot of learning lessons along the way. And right now, based on their record, sure it's not the best, but looking at that lineup and looking at their pitching rotation, there are younger players who are starting to establish a presence here in the major leagues. And that is something that Sox fans should be looking forward to. Now, from the diamond to the gridiron, we're going to move on now and take a look at some Chicago Bears news. Now, the last podcast we did was before all of their free agency acquisitions, so right now we're going to take a look at all of them and see what they can bring to the table. First, we've got Trey Burton coming here from the Philadelphia Eagles, just winning a Super Bowl. Now, Burton over in Philadelphia, not necessarily the big-time tight end. In fact, he was 3rd on the depth chart behind Zach Ertz and Brent Celek. He did, however, gain valuable experience being on a team like that and being teammates with both Celek and Ertz. Ertz, by the way, a Pro Bowl tight end. Burton will come here and most likely be able to start or at least compete to start with Adam Shaheen, as it's looking like Deion Sims will be number 3 on the tight end depth chart. We move to quarterback, and right now the Bears made an acquisition for Mitchell Trubisky's backup. It's going to be Chase Daniel coming from New Orleans. Daniel, not much time in actual games, but a good mentor for Trubisky because he was teammates with Drew Brees for a long time. Daniel can provide some insight for Trubisky and can also supplement the advice Trubisky has been getting from Mark Sanchez. So 2 very good quarterback minds helping to navigate Trubisky as he gets going here in his second season in the league. Couple of wide receivers, something that the Bears really needed some improvement in. They made some moves, getting Taylor Gabriel and Allen Robinson. Now, Robinson is the big one, obviously. He was the consensus best wide receiver amongst the free agent class, and that's thinking about the fact that he didn't even play last year. He tore his ACL and has been recovering. Hopefully, he'll be ready for the season opener in September. But nevertheless, Robinson, a true number one wide receiver. He had that role in Jacksonville and used it to his advantage, catching 80 passes for 1,400 yards in 2015 en route to a Pro Bowl appearance, and in 2016, 73 catches for 883 yards. And the yards went down, of course, but you had to remember who he was dealing with at the time. That's Blake Bortles. Here with Trubisky, Robinson should be very effective, and I'm expecting no less than a 1,000-yard season as a wide receiver. The Bears also, as I mentioned, got Taylor Gabriel, coming from the Atlanta Falcons. Gabriel last season, a bit of a down year, 378 yards, 33 receptions. The year before, the year in which Atlanta made it to the Super Bowl, Gabriel with 35 catches for 579 yards. Obviously not a number one wide receiver. In Atlanta, he was behind Mohamed Sanu and, of course, Julio Jones. But Gabriel, with the Bears right now, could be a good number two or three, depending on if Cameron Meredith is going to return or end up going to the Saints due to their offer sheet. The Bears also improved defensively, getting linebacker Aaron Lynch from the San Francisco 49ers. Lynch last season played only in 7 games. He did have some injuries, recorded 1 sack, but his first 2 years in the NFL, in 2014 and 2015, he did awesome. 6 sacks and 6.5 sacks each year, respectively, and anchor a defense for the 49ers. He'll come here to the Bears and supplement Leonard Floyd and really form a very good linebacker core. Then we've got a kicker. Finally, the Bears decided to invest some serious money in getting a kicker. And, you know, I laugh, but it's no joke, because Connor Barth last year blew multiple games for the team, and obviously, we all remember what happened when Robbie Gould was here and then left. He did horrible as well, so the Bears finally investing in a quality kicker, Cody Parkey, who comes here by way of the Miami Dolphins. Last season, Parkey, 21 of 23 in field goals made, a 91.3 field goal percentage. That is amazing. And his extra point percentage at 90. He had a great season last year in Miami, the year before in Cleveland, okay, but really turned it on last year. Hopefully he can replicate that success for the Bears, as they are in need of a kicker. One who can make kicks, of course, but one who can also win games when needed. As we know, Gould and Barth could not step up on the big stage and make a kick to win a game. Hopefully Cody Parkey will have the ability to make it happen for the Bears. We'll move on now and talk about some Chicago Bulls news. The Bulls right now, 27-53. They're currently tied with the Nets for the 12th and 13th seeds in the Eastern Conference. But that means nothing right now, because what we're worried about is tanking. Where are the Bulls going to end up in the draft order? Right now, it's actually kind of a race to limp to the finish, because the Knicks are at 28-52, the Bulls at 27-53, and the Magic at 24-56. So there are some chances here for the Bulls to lose more and move up in the order, which is the goal at this point. ESPN recently released an NBA mock draft, their first one of the year, just a preliminary one. Right now, they have the Bulls at number 7, taking Trae Young, while passing on Michael Porter Jr., Colin Sexton, and Mikal Bridges. Either way, this is going to be a very strong draft class. The Bulls with Trae Young, you know what? I have no problem with that. If you need to move Chris Dunn to accommodate Trae Young, so be it. I have no problem with Young seeing some advanced minutes at the NBA level early. But right now, I'm hoping the Bulls can move up a bit, or I'm hoping some teams can pass up on my guy, Marvin Bagley III from Duke, a power forward slash center. This guy has the potential to average 20-10 in the NBA, somewhat similar to a Karl-Anthony Towns, or an Anthony Davis per se. He is someone I am really looking forward to, and I hope the Bulls can either move up or some other teams could pass on him so the Bulls can get him. Another guy who the Bulls need to look at is Michael Porter Jr., and I know the alarms are going off for many, because Porter, in all actuality, only played 2 minutes in his entire collegiate career. So again, that is going to raise some red flags with people. If he can't even get a chance to play in college, how is he basically going to jump from the high school to the NBA? Now, I know other players have done it. Kobe Bryant, Kevin Garnett, to name a few. So Porter himself may not necessarily have a problem with that. And Porter is a very good player. Let's talk about some stats for a minute. Porter has achieved a 100.0 rating on 247 Sports, which is a very popular recruiting-based website for players from high school going into college. Other players who have achieved that rating: Kevin Durant, Dwight Howard, Andrew Wiggins, and LeBron James. Porter is also 6'10". He has elite size. He could be somebody who can play shooting guard or point guard like a Ben Simmons, or center if you need him to. The options are really endless with him. And you know what my favorite part about Porter is? It's the fact that he is a shooter, man. 6'10" shooter. Here's an article from RockMNation.com regarding Porter and his talents. Quote, Porter's best quality is his ability to shoot. With his height and high finish to his jump shot, he's difficult to defend on pull-ups. He's also skilled enough that if you try to move a bigger player onto him to affect his shooting, he can just drive right by them. He's a really, really tough matchup, particularly at the college level. Michael Porter Jr. is the real deal. And here's one thing I have to say on the subject. If you think that the Bulls are making a better move by drafting Trae Young over Michael Porter Jr., I'm sorry, but you're dead wrong. Michael Porter Jr. is a better, more quality player than Young. We saw Young, of course, take the nation by storm early in the year. But have you heard from him lately? I didn't think so, because everybody understood how to defend him and how to neutralize his game. And keep in mind, that was at the college level. Imagine what happens once he gets to the NBA and tries to pull some of his antics that he did in college. It's not going to happen. I am a little bit worried, frankly, about Trae Young and about his potential in the NBA. If I were John Paxson, and if I were Gar Foreman, and if I were the Bulls, I would most definitely take Michael Porter Jr. over Trae Young. Of course, if Marvin Bagley's available, so be it. Take him, of course. But the Bulls have many options this year. Let's hope they can make a right decision, because we all know the Bulls and their past draft history. Let's hope they can make the correct decision for themselves and for their extensive fan base. And finally, before we get to our special guest, I'd like to take a look at the Chicago Blackhawks, and what a disappointing year it has been for them. Their season just about ready to end. Right now, they've scored 76 points all season. This is their fewest since earning 71 in 06 and 07, their most recent last place season. How crazy is that? I mean, it's kind of like the end of a dynasty, the end of an era, you know. I mean, this team has been so dominant for about a decade, 8 or 9 years, I'd say, and this year it has really just bottomed out. Right now, the team has announced that John McDonough, Stan Bowman, and Joel Quenneville will all return for next season. Here are some things that Stan Bowman, the general manager, believes about the team. Now, right now, he believes that the poor seasons by several top players are an anomaly. And by the way, by poor seasons, I'm talking about Jonathan Toews scoring only 20 goals, a career low. Brandon Saad scoring 18 goals, and Duncan Keith with a minus 29 rating, the worst of his career. Bowman believes that all these guys simply had bad years, and it was one of those years for the Hawks. He thinks they can all rebound and be ready for next season. Also, Bowman wants Corey Crawford healthy, and that has been a storyline all year. Crawford has continually gotten hurt and has starred in minimal games for the team this year. Having a healthy goalie is something very important for an NHL team. If Crawford can be ready to go in the 2018-19 season, that will simply help the Hawks by not giving up many more goals and allowing them to have more chances to be in the driver's seat during games. And also, Bowman believes that he needs more time before he can evaluate the true winner of the trade in which Brandon Saad was reacquired and Artemi Panarin was sent to the Blue Jackets. Although Saad did very bad this season, hopefully he can pick it up next year and balance out that trade, because Panarin was a real spark plug for this Hawks offensive attack. Say what you want, but this is the end of an era for the Blackhawks. I mean, I remember when they made it to the Stanley Cup and they won it. I was watching that game. It was amazing to see. And now seeing them back at this low, back before the time in which the Hawks accumulated so many fans and won so many games, it's quite frightening to say the least. I mean, it's really frightening. Hopefully this Hawks team will have a chance to figure it out this offseason and come into next year well prepared for what's ahead. And hopefully Bowman's predictions about the team, especially the fact that certain players just had anomalies for seasons, really mean something. Because when it comes down to it, the Hawks definitely need the likes of Taves and Keith and Saad to produce for them. If those three guys cannot step up next year, it's going to be another long year for the Chicago Blackhawks. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his broadcast journalism career right here in Chicago, working on WMAQ-TV as a sports anchor. After his time here in the Windy City, he worked for MSG, ESPN, and WFAN Radio in New York City. In 1988, he became a part of CBS Sports, broadcasting for NFL, MLB, NBA, and college basketball games. After a brief stint with NBC, he returned to CBS, where he still is today, broadcasting NFL games while serving as a studio host during March Madness. Please welcome Greg Gumbel to the show. Greg, how are you doing today? Thank you for being here on the show. It's quite an honor.
I'm glad to be with you, John, although it's fairly evident by my resume that I can't hold a job.
Oh, first off, Greg, I'd like to take a look back at this season's NCAA March Madness tournament. What a year it was. Specifically, many surprises like Loyola Chicago, a UMBC winning over Virginia. What is your take on this year's tournament and the national championship, which featured yet another Villanova win?
Well, I thought first of all that it was a better tournament than we've had over the last few years. Last few years have kind of missed the buzzer beaters. They've missed a lot of upsets. There were some here and there, but not nearly as much as we were used to, say, 8, 10, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, and I thought that this year's tournament had more of that. Park Kellogg and I have argued for a long time. He said, and I'll never let him forget this, he said that a 16 seed will never beat a 1, and I said, well, that's ridiculous. Of course it'll happen. We may not live to see it, but it's going to happen one day, and frankly it happened a little sooner than I thought it would, because I thought Virginia was a possible eventual national champion. But, you know, it's like I always say, in basketball, there's no guarantee that everyone is going to bring their jump shot to the gym that night. And if they don't, then you stand the chance of being upset. And upsets and buzzer beaters are really what the NCAA tournament is made of, and filling out brackets and all of that good stuff. I thought it was a very good tournament.
You know, you were talking about upsets. There are some critics, though, who think that, okay, it's only one game, that doesn't really measure a team's true capacity. But at the same time, you know, isn't that the beauty of the tournament? Having teams making upsets, having teams who you wouldn't necessarily recognize earlier in the year then make a big push in the tournament like we saw Loyola do this year.
Sure, it's not necessarily, you know, well, this defines a team. It defines that team for that evening. You know, and you know what, in all honesty, that's the problem with early round upsets, because they move on in the tournament, and quite often they come up against a bigger beast and they get smashed, and you know, where you got the thrill of an upset in the first round, the second round comes along and that winner of the upset game might get creamed by about 30 or 35 points. So, but that's going to happen, and you're right, that is the beauty of the tournament, the fact that it can happen, and that even the kingpins never know when it might hit them, because as I say, you don't always bring your jump shot to the gym.
You know, we're talking about Loyola Chicago for a moment. I mean, what a year they had, an 11 seed coming in, they make it all the way to the Final Four. In your opinion, what prompted their success, really? I mean, coming in as an 11 seed, we knew that earlier on in the year they had some upsets against Florida, most specifically. But what helped them go so far in this tournament this year?
Well, first of all, I think it was pretty obvious that they gained an awful lot of confidence in themselves and in their game. I was impressed by their game. I thought Coach Mosier had them running. I made the comment on air that they reminded me of those Princeton teams that always gave Georgetown fits because they were so precision. Everybody was in motion. They were playing basket, move the ball, backdoor basketball, and didn't shoot the threes unless they had to, unless they were wide open. And it made for good basketball, and it worked for them, and I think they caught a couple of teams by surprise.
So regarding March Madness, one final question. What surprised you most about this year's tournament? I mean, I know Loyola, we talked about UMBC, Arizona losing early, another big shocker. What surprised you the most about this year's tournament?
Oh, I just thought that, you know, you would like to think, and it's in a one-and-done format, it's difficult for the better team to always win. Best 4 out of 7, no question. The best team is going to win in 4 out of 7 because you can't go every single night without your jump shot. But in a one-and-done situation, it absolutely can happen. I do think, however, when all was said and done, the best team won the tournament. Villanova was a team that down the stretch got stronger and stronger, as did Michigan. You know, Michigan started their run back in the Big Ten postseason tournament and just got more and more impressive. And when it came down to the championship game, Villanova was the better team by far. That's all.
So I wanted to shift gears now and talk about some NFL news and notes. Now, this offseason has been quite busy. Many big-name players moving to other teams. To name a few, Jarvis Landry to the Browns and Brandon Cooks to the Rams. That was as recent as a week ago. So which teams, in your mind, have won the offseason so far?
I don't think there's any question it's the Cleveland Browns. Now, that's prior to the draft, and we'll see what happens with that. But with the Browns, you know they're going to pick a quarterback at number one, and you know if things fall right, they may get the best running back in a long, long time with the fourth pick. And if that happens, the Cleveland Browns are going to be a team to reckon with. Nobody knows yet how good those kids are going to be, but they know they're going to be good. And if they get a little seasoning under their belt, I happen to be a big admirer of Hugh Jackson, their head coach, who I think knows his football and has done a great job in nurturing quarterbacks along the way, quarterbacks who have talent. And I think the Browns are going to be fun to watch. I also think, yeah, there are several teams that have improved themselves, but you know, the way the NFL shapes up, you know, there are people who make it their business to do predictions prior to the start of the season, which I think is stupid, because you never know how those draft picks are going to play. You never know how the loss of certain free agents is going to affect the team. You never know how the acquisition of certain free agents is going to affect the team. And you know, the rookies that arrive, how are they going to blend in? I don't think you ever really know what kind of a team you have in the NFL until you get to around week 4, week 5, maybe even week 6 before everybody settles in and everybody realizes what's going on and they begin to play football the way everyone figures they can. But there's no question the Cleveland Browns are going to be a really, really interesting football team for years to come.
You know, touching on the Browns, we all know they have the number one pick, so you're thinking right now most likely going to be a quarterback with that selection?
I would be surprised if it isn't. I don't know that they feel that they're set at the quarterback position. And when you have promising guys like Sam Darnold and Josh Rosen, and Josh Allen sitting there waiting to be taken, and you know the guys behind you want them. You know, if they take, if whatever quarterback, whatever number one quarterback they pick, the Giants sitting right behind them are going to take the second one, and the Jets right behind them are going to take the third one. So I think that's pretty obvious, and I think it's a good call. You know, the one position on the football field where you need a playmaker and a game changer is quarterback.
So now I wanted to move on and talk about your amazing career in broadcast journalism. I'd love to hear about your story, how you ended up rising to the top. I know it did involve your brother. It's pretty interesting. If you don't mind, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, you know, he's a nosy busybody, as everybody who knows him knows. I was actually selling, Brian's been in the business about 4 years longer than I have, and I was selling hospital supplies in the city of Detroit, and he called me one day in 1973. And he asked me he told me that there was a weekend sportscasting position open at the NBC affiliate in Chicago, and if I were interested. And so I flew in and I auditioned with a bunch of other people, and they said, don't call us, we'll call you. And 3 weeks later they called. So that's how I got started. And I spent 7.5 years at MAQ there, and then 5.5 at ESPN, 3 years at Madison Square Garden, and then went to CBS, and then NBC, and then back to CBS after that.
Wow, that's extremely impressive. And your accolades, too, they're simply incredible. I mean, you've won multiple Emmy Awards for your broadcasting skills. You've called 2 Super Bowls on TV for CBS. So what do you attribute your success to, and do you have any advice for younger broadcasters today trying to break into the business?
Well, first of all, the options for young broadcast wannabes are numerous, and they weren't numerous back then when I was starting. You know, right now, everybody has a need for sportscasting because there are, what, 80,000 TV channels? every one of them want to present sports in some way, shape, or form on whatever platforms. So I was fortunate, and Bryant and I have never denied the fact that we were very fortunate, you know, to be in such a competitive business. And I started in Chicago and he started in Los Angeles. You know, there are people who are very talented who never, for whatever reasons, find their way out of Keokuk, Iowa, or Battle Creek, Michigan, or Yuma, Arizona. So we were very fortunate to do that. The other thing that I firmly believe is that Channel 5 in Chicago was looking for someone of color. And while people may decry that, I don't, because I was the lucky recipient of it. Now, it doesn't mean that just because you're black and they're looking for someone black that they'll keep you. If they're looking for someone black and you can't do the job, they'll find someone else who's black. So that's no guarantee, but it did give me the opportunity. I think I was hired at ESPN for that same reason. Now, after that, I happen to think it was because, for whatever reason, people along the way have liked and enjoyed what I do. And in that, I'm very fortunate, especially because I never, ever took a communications course in school. Neither did Bryant. Bryant was a Russian history major. I was an English major. And the options that happened in broadcasting happened to come our way, and we happened to be able to capitalize on them. And I think it's really as simple as that. As for people who are looking to get into the business, I would just keep knocking on doors if I were them. Keep talking into tape recorders. Keep listening to yourself. I found the worst thing in the world. I still find it difficult to listen to myself because I hate the sound of my voice. But I think that if you do it, then you kind of hear what you say wrong. You kind of recognize if you have words that you lean on as a crutch, and you avoid those. And I think that you force yourself to make yourself better.
And on a final note, I wanted to ask you about your depiction in Family Guy as a crime-fighting duo with your brother Bryant. Personally, I thought it was quite funny seeing you two in that role. How did that come about, and what were your thoughts on it?
We didn't have any clue. They just did it. and I've been a fan of the show for a long time, and having watched the show for a long time, Bryant and I agree, they could have been a lot tougher on us. They could have been a lot meaner. It could have been very embarrassing. I thought they treated us very nicely and very well, and I was thrilled to have been a part of it, to be honest with you. I still watch the show regularly. I think it's one of the funniest shows on television. And but yeah, every once in a while someone will come across and say, didn't you do it? Yeah. Was that your family? Was that your voice? No, we didn't do any voiceovers. We were just depicted. And you know, the way you see some others depicted, we came off very, very well.
All right, Greg, thank you so much for being here on the show. It was quite an honor and a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it. Best to you and your listeners.
Thank you. What an honor it was to have Greg Gumbel here on the show. I was talking to him off the air, and he was telling me that he grew up right here in Hyde Park in Chicago, right around the Woodlawn area on 55th Street. So, really cool stuff, a Chicago native, and now a big-time announcer with CBS. Great guy to have on the show. To end the podcast today, we're going to get to our favorite segment, the announcer's call of the day. And of course, having Greg Gumbel on the show means we need to have a call from him. So we've got one queued up here and ready to go. Let's take a look at the situation. This happened last year. Chicago Bears taking on the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's tied at 17 in overtime. The Bears need a touchdown to win the game. If they score a field goal, they have to keep playing. Here's Greg Gumbel on the call.
Howard left side, to the 10, to the 5, game over.
What? What a call there by Greg Gumbel. And if you can recall in that game, that was the time in which the Bears returned a blocked field goal all the way to the 1 yard line before Marcus Cooper stopped before the goal line and got the ball punched out of his hands. So the Bears technically didn't really need to be in that situation, but they ended up winning, and Greg Gumbel got to make another historic call. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. We thank you all for listening. Make sure to hit us up on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram, all at JohnZags. Also, if you'd like to get some updates as to when we post new articles and podcasts, find the subscription box on our site and enter your email. Next time we post something new, it will go directly to your email and you will be the first to know. Thank you again for listening and have a great day.